Over the past decade, homicide numbers have fallen in the United States. At the same time, homicide rates for young black men have increased substantially, and non-fatal injuries are even more common. Now, this kind of violence certainly gets a lot of attention in the media, but it is very rare for these young men who are victims of this violence to talk about their experiences and to do that in their own voices. And that was something that our guest for this hour of Focus, Dr. John Rich, was trying to get at in a book that he's authored. It's recently out. The title of his book is Wrong Place, Wrong Time, Trauma and Violence in the Lives of Young Black Men. And it's published by the Johns Hopkins University Press. And it tries to get at what is going on in the lives of these young men, what it is that raises their risk of being involved in violence, either as perpetrator or as victim. And then looking at some broader issues of in what sorts of ways this kind of violence and exposure to this violence affects their health, both perhaps their mental health and also their physical health. And that's what we'll be talking about here this morning in this part of the show. Our guest, Dr. John Rich, he's a physician. He's professor, chair of the Department of Health Management and Policy at Drexel University School of Public Health. That's in Philadelphia. Before going to Drexel, Dr. Rich served as the medical director for the Boston Public Health Commission. That's the health department for the city of Boston. He was also associate professor of medicine and public health at Boston University and served as an attending physician at Boston Medical Center. He's an expert in inner city health problems, particularly urban violence, men's health, and racial disparities. He's also founder, director of the Young Men's Health Clinic at Boston Medical Center, and that's a primary care center designed to meet the health needs of young men in the inner city. He's joining us this morning by telephone. As we talk, questions are welcome. If you'd like to call in, we have two numbers for you to use. The first, the local number, 333-9455. That's for people who are in Champaign-Urbana, here where we are. If it would be long-distance call, use the toll-free line, 800-222-9455. You may also email your comments to will-talk, so that's just like it sounds, W-I-L-L-talk, at illinois.edu. We welcome questions, comments. We certainly hope people will keep it brief. We ask that to keep things moving along, but anybody who is interested in calling in is welcome to do that. Dr. Rich, hello.
Hello.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
It's my pleasure.
I think you explain that as a physician, the kind of medicine that you were practicing there when you were in Boston, you generally did not see the kind of young men that we're talking about in your practice. They don't have health insurance. They don't have a regular relationship with a physician. And chances are when they come into the hospital, they're coming into the emergency room for treatment from some kind of violent injury. And you explained your own reaction and perhaps the reaction of people that end up treating them as kind of being the same, all being the same. And that is that I think you've put it this way, not just that they say someone came in with a gunshot wound. It was not just that he was shot. It was that he got himself shot. And that is somehow something that he did in a direct sort of a way resulted in this injury. Maybe we could start there and just talk about the difficulty of people in the healthcare system to relate to the life conditions that these young men have.
Well, I think you've stated it exactly right. When I was practicing in a primary care clinic as an internal medicine primary care specialist, I noticed that these young men were conspicuously absent from the part of healthcare where we get to sit and talk with people and hear about their lives. Rather, they were being seen in the more emergent, preventable places, whether it might be the orthopedic clinic because they had a broken bone or the sexually transmitted disease clinic, but also the emergency department and the surgical wards. And certainly the job of medical providers in those emergency settings is to save the person's life. And if you come in with a gunshot wound, often the providers are so focused on saving your life, getting you to the operating room, as they should be, there's not much opportunity to understand what happened to you or even hear that story. And because young African-American men in many cities tend to dress alike, that is sometimes typical Timberland boots and jeans and maybe a hooded sweatshirt, when they come in that moment, they tend to blend together. And because of that moment, and because of all of the influences on not only doctors and nurses, but all of us in the society that says this is what a young black man is, implicitly, we just sort of start to believe that we know them. Oh, they must have been drug dealers. They must have been doing something they shouldn't have been doing. And as an African-American man and physician, as I began to talk with these young men and try and understand their lives, I realized that I had held some stereotypical ideas. That is, I didn't understand how nuanced and how complicated it could be. So, for example, a young person might have gone to a party and talked to a girl and not realized that her boyfriend was there, and because of these issues of respect and disrespect, might have ended up shot after that. And that's a pretty normal activity, going to a party. Or might have been walking down the street, going out late at night to get food at a fast food store, and been robbed. And that is, again, sort of a normal activity. And so for me to understand that there wasn't simply this idea that they were good or bad, but rather that there was a lot more complexity in their experience was important to change how I was seeing them when they came in.
Yeah. This issue here, I think, is really important because, as you note, that when people think in a sort of an impersonal way, when they think of the stereotype of the young black man, they often think about them as a threat to public safety. And what seems to be very critical here is that for these young men, in the lives that they lived and the communities that they come from, they're actually really preoccupied with their own safety. And there's a very critical fear here that they have on a continuing basis for their own safety, which then leads to other consequences and other behaviors.
I think that's absolutely right. We have often seen young black men as epitomized as criminals or gangsters. And other sociologists, like Elijah Anderson, have written about this, particularly in circumstances that tend to cut off communication, like an emergency room. It's easy to revert to our stereotypes about who these people are. But when I sat and talked with these young people and began to gather their stories systematically, I realized that there was this deeper issue of safety, and that much of the issue of respect really could be reduced to thinking about safety. And this is how the young people talk about it. When I was interviewing young men, they started to use the word sucker. You know, they didn't want to be a sucker. And I realized that they were using it in a way that was different from the way that I had grown up, you know, many years ago thinking about it. I thought of a sucker as somebody who was easily fooled. But they were really saying a sucker is somebody who, if someone does something to them or says something to them, they don't retaliate. You wouldn't want to be a sucker in the inner city because then everyone will take advantage of you. And the real idea there is if you let people victimize you and you look weak, then other people will victimize you. Now, this idea isn't so unfamiliar to the rest of us. If you think about it, many workplaces or many other environments, there's an idea that, well, you better stand up for yourself, lest other people take advantage of you. And some have even said that's a kind of national foreign policy posture that the United States has, which is basically, you know, make sure that you show yourself strong so that others don't take advantage. So we shouldn't think about this as a kind of exotic idea, but when it plays out in very dangerous neighborhoods where there are a lot of guns, young people can sometimes feel like the only way to protect themselves is to get a gun. And if you feel that way, even if you've been a victim and you're suffering the symptoms of trauma and you're feeling very unsafe, getting a gun, we know, will make you less safe and may make you more likely to do harm to someone else. So we get caught in a vicious circle if we don't understand that safety is really a fundamental need of all of these young people.
Yeah. And here it connects to another important theme, and apparently one of the things that when you talked with young men that they told you, the things that characterize their lives, one major theme is extreme mistrust of police and past bad relations with police, to the point where apparently a lot of these young men would say, you know, if I was in trouble, the last place that I would look for help is from the police, which there again leads a person to feel that no one's going to take care of you. You're going to have to take care of yourself.
That's right. And I think there's a mutual mistrust between these young men and the police. And so the police expect bad actions from these young men, and they expect not to be treated fairly by the police. And they have had experiences in their lives where they've been stopped, where it's been assumed that they were involved in something that they weren't. And so given that, they're more likely to feel like, well, I should handle this myself. And some of the idea that, you know, you want to show yourself to be strong is that you handle your own business. But to the extent that in these communities, young people believe that even when you call the police, they don't come, or when you call the police to help you, they assume actually that you're the person who needs to be restrained, or that somehow you're belligerent in that activity, does mean that young people feel often, these young men express that they feel like they have to handle it themselves. And that's a problem for all of us, because some of our work has to be improving relationships between these young people in communities and the police so that they feel more empowered to call upon the resources that all of the rest of us depend upon, rather than feeling as though they're responsible always for making sure that they're safe.
Hmm. Just to kind of round things out a little bit at this point, I want to refer back to the title of the book, Wrong Place, Wrong Time. And one of the things that I know that you've said is that when you sit down and you're talking with young men who have experienced this kind of violence, you say sooner or later, they're going to utter that phrase. They're going to say to you, well, Doc, I guess I was just in the wrong place at the wrong time. And the response of healthcare workers often when they hear that is, well, that's just an excuse. But it seems that from the point of view of the young man, there's a sort of almost fatalistic expectation that sooner or later that's going to happen. That they're going to directly experience this kind of violence. That it's all in the communities where they live, and it may well be because they've seen so much of it. That seems to be a fact of life.
You know, that phrase "wrong place, wrong time" has stuck in my mind since the first time that I heard it uttered by a young person, and I've thought about it. In many cases, what was perplexing was that they weren't actually in the wrong place. They were on their way to do maybe to school, or they were coming back from a concert, or they were at a party. And while there were some young people who were involved in selling drugs or were involved in gang activity, the vast majority of the young people I talked to weren't involved in those things, and they still said that. And so I began to understand it, as you've said, that there is a sense that eventually you're going to come up against violence in your life, and that there's a randomness that leaves it out of your control. At the same time, there's probably something that is universal there, which is that when something bad happens to any of us, we think, well, what would have happened if I had done something differently? What if I had decided to stay home that day? Or what if I had decided to walk down a different street? So I think part of Wrong Place, Wrong Time is trying to make sense of what happened to you and trying to figure out what it really means for you. But as you mentioned, when young people say that unconnected to their real story, it sounds as though they're saying, I take no responsibility for what happened to me. And when people who, like most physicians who did not grow up in the same circumstances as these young people, hear that, they often see it as a relinquishing all responsibility. I don't think that's what they're saying. I think they are sometimes reflecting on, why is it that I can't walk down my street in my neighborhood wearing my jewelry and expect that I can be safe? I think it's a broader sense that there ought to be fewer of these wrong place, wrong time experiences in their lives.
Just one more point. I want to come back again to underscore, and we'll go to a call that we have here. There is, I expect, a lot of people have this assumption that these young men who get hurt, that the fact that they got hurt was somehow the result, one way or another, of their involvement in some kind of illegal activity. Sounds as if you're saying is that in most cases, that's not true. It's not, they're not hurt because they were perpetrating a crime, because they were robbing somebody, because they were involved in a gang fight at that moment, or anything like that.
I think the word that you use that's most problematic is assumption. We have this sense that we don't have to ask, we don't have to gather the story of this young person. Involvement in criminal activity is a part of the lives of some of the young people that I talked with, but this issue of disrespect, the issue of intense feelings of unsafety, is more important, I believe, in the injuries that we see than involvement in criminal activity. So that if you really believe that you have to defend yourself against any slight and that your basic safety is at risk, that helps us understand why it is that you can hear about somebody stepping on somebody's foot and that leading to a fight and a severe injury or maybe even a killing, is that it doesn't have to do so much with the stepping on the foot. It has to do with the sense that respect is everything, that it not only defines how you stay safe, but it defines who you are in the world. But let me say one other thing, and that is, as we try and understand what's happening in the lives and the minds of these young people, in trying to understand what happens in their lives, I'm not, and they are not, offering an excuse for it. That is to say, as I say that young people sometimes get guns because they feel unsafe, I'm not excusing that. I think it's a terrible idea. I think we know from data that it makes you less safe to have a gun. In this society, there's a sense somehow that getting a gun will make you safer. But unless we come to understand what these young people are thinking, we can't address their concerns by simply lecturing them or wagging our fingers in their faces, telling them our experiences, which are quite unlike their experiences. We have to understand the logic and the sense-making that underlies the actions that they take. And we can only do that by hearing their voices.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Dr. John Rich. He's professor and chair of the Department of Health Management and Policy at Drexel University in Philadelphia. He also helped to establish the Center for Nonviolence and Social Justice at the Drexel University School of Public Health. That's a center that focuses on urban trauma as a public health issue and also works to provide a program of healing for victims of violence. He is the author of a recently published book. The title is Wrong Place, Wrong Time, Trauma and Violence in the Lives of Young Black Men, and it is published by the Johns Hopkins University Press. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. We have a caller here. It must be someone listening online. They're calling from Seattle, Washington, on our line 4. Hello.
Hi. Yep. This is a really interesting discussion, and I'm getting a good sense of a lot of the why from what you're talking about, why, the mindset of the participants in this violence, it begins to make sense when you put yourself inside the mindset. But something I've been curious about is how did this come to be? I would say that 30 years ago, or maybe a little longer than that, it just wasn't so violent and dangerous. And if the guest has a sense of how things evolved to be so crazy, what forces drove that? I'd be curious to hear about that.
You raise a really good question. As David pointed out at the beginning of the show, there seems to be less homicide if you look across our statistics than there was, say, 30 or 40 years ago. But I think among young people in inner city, they have felt ever more marginalized from the mainstream of society, and there's been a proliferation of hopelessness over time. And so I think that young people, and I don't know whether this is much different from the past, but the young people I talk to do feel like they have less opportunity. And the less opportunity they have, the more they feel as though their identity is bound up in how they prove that they're men, how they protect their respect. I think that we also have guns, and the lethality of these weapons matters. So I often hear people say, you know, 30 years ago, we dealt with things with our fists. We didn't resort to firearms. And so I think that the availability of firearms in urban communities has contributed to this. But I think it is a question that we need to try and better understand, even beyond the narratives that these young men tell. How is it that their lives are more extreme, and why is it that they feel so bound up in the issues of violence?
I hope that that gets at the question of the caller. Others are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. And I guess I also wanted to, again, have you give you the chance to make the point that the levels of violence not only is fatal violence high. Homicide is the leading cause of death for young black men, and their homicide rate is 19 times that of young white men. But also the level of non-fatal violence is also extraordinarily high. The CDC estimates for every homicide in the U.S. there are over 94 cases of non-fatal violent injuries. So even beyond the number of people who are killed, the number of people who are non-fatally shot or stabbed or end up being beaten is staggeringly high.
That is a critical point for us to understand, because most of us measure what happens in our communities by the homicide reports. But in many cities, urban centers, there isn't enough space in the newspaper even to report on the individual homicide victims. And so we often have, and this was true in Philadelphia, we often just have this number sitting in our heads. And when that number goes up or down, we feel like we're either losing ground or making up ground. But the truth is that many young people are affected by violence that is non-fatal. It may not even be violence that leads them to get medical care. But the consequences of those forms of violence go beyond the physical injuries. We know that there is a consequence of violence that leads to really the kind of post-traumatic stress and other stress-related problems that we often see in combat veterans. That is, if you've been injured by violence, there's a likelihood that you will develop nightmares, flashbacks, depression, acute feelings of jumpiness and unsafety, that you may actually develop a sort of emotional numbing that leaves you unable to feel fear or unable to feel love. These are well-described psychological and medical phenomena. But we often fail to think about this with regard to young people in the inner city. You don't have to have been injured, by the way, to develop these kinds of trauma-related problems. You can be a witness to violence and develop them. And so I believe that we have whole groups of young people in the urban environment who are suffering from trauma-related symptoms but don't know it because it's not widely talked about, and because they are largely uninsured and alienated or cut off from medical and behavioral care, they don't have any avenue for treating that. So left with no option, I heard a lot of young people say, you know, I get these nightmares, and so I just smoke weed, and that helps me go to sleep, or I drink alcohol. And so we get a cycle where young people may be treating themselves for symptoms that are a result of their either direct or indirect exposure to violence. The good news is that we have ways of treating that if we can provide these young people with access to health care and healing services either right at the time that they get injured or sometime after in follow-up so that they can regain their sense of safety and move on with their lives.
Yeah, and so that really it makes it very critical that in this very small window that you have, this very small time that they're there, you don't have very much time, and that's a really critical period to get to them. So having having staff sensitive to what's going on in their lives and also doing something, as I know you've done, you've been involved in trying to do a project that would provide what, you know, for want of a better term, we might call peer counselors, people there to talk with these young men that they can relate to, that a number of important things have to be in place, because if you don't get them right then, you're maybe not going to get them.
That's right. And it's complicated by the fact that only about 1 in 10 victims of violence, when we take all forms, who come to the emergency department for treatment gets actually admitted to the hospital. So the majority of people, even for some gunshot wounds that don't hit a vital organ, may actually be sent out within hours of the time that they came in. And so there is a limited window to see them and to try and make a difference. And so we have taken an approach, and others have as well, that's called a trauma-informed approach. And under the leadership of Dr. Theodore Corbin here in Philadelphia at the Hahnemann Medical Center, there's one example called Healing Hurt People. The idea is when the young person comes in who's been injured, a social worker sees that person, sees what their needs are, hears something about the story, but also orients this young person to the fact that, listen, in the next few days, it's likely that you'll experience nightmares. You might have some flashbacks. You might feel unsafe. Don't get a gun. Don't smoke a lot of weed, but let's help you get through that. The social worker also evaluates whether they're at risk for retaliating because they feel like they've been disrespected. But these, we also found that many of the young people, not surprisingly, who are injured, need connection. They need connection to education. They need connection to work. Many of the young people we saw didn't even have any form of identification. And so we have a navigator, a person who comes from the communities, who has experienced some of the same things as these young people, who basically helps them get to those resources that they need. And that's critical. It's not just, here's a list, here's a name, call this number, but rather, let me help you figure out how to get this. And then finally, what you referred to is a type of healing group. It's a psychoeducational group, which really just means we're talking about issues. We're not asking them to pour out all of their trauma, where we focus on four areas: safety, how you deal with your emotions, how you deal with loss. Many of these young people have lost friends and family. They've lost function in their bodies. And then how do you envision a future? And this is something that young people themselves ask for. They said, I don't think I can sit with a therapist who doesn't know my experience, doesn't look like me, and talk about my life. But I would sit in a group with other young people who have experienced the same thing and talk about these issues. And so it's a facilitated group by a professional who helps walk young people through how do you make your way back to safety and how do you envision a future for your life. Here, the challenge for this sort of intervention, though, is that by and large, insurance doesn't pay for that. And many of these young people aren't insured. And so if we were to envision a way to try, at least from the healthcare setting, to interrupt the cycle of violence, we would have to advocate in a larger way for healthcare coverage that makes sense and covers everyone and covers the types of needs that these young people have.
Well, we're a bit past our midpoint here, and I'd like to, for anybody who might have tuned in just in the last 5 or 10 minutes, I'd like to introduce again the guest. We're talking with Dr. John Rich. He's a physician. He's professor, chair of the Department of Health Management and Policy at the Drexel University School of Public Health. That's in Philadelphia. Before going to Drexel, he served as the medical director with the Boston Public Health Commission. That's the health department for the city of Boston. He was also associate professor of medicine and public health at Boston University. He served as an attending physician physician at Boston Medical Center. He's an expert in inner-city health problems, particularly urban violence, men's health, and racial disparities. He's also founder and director of the Young Men's Health Clinic at Boston Medical Center, a primary care clinic designed to meet the health needs of young men in the inner city. He also helped establish the Center for Nonviolence and Social Justice at Drexel, at the School of Public Health there. They focus on urban trauma as a public health issue and provide a program of healing for victims of violence. He is also the author of a recently published book. The title of this book is Wrong Place, Wrong Time, Trauma and Violence in the Lives of Young Black Men. And it's published by the Johns Hopkins University Press. And as we explained a little bit earlier, this is really an attempt on his part to give some voice to these young men, to have them tell their stories, something that we just don't get in the media and the way that it covers violence in the inner city. Questions, comments, they're certainly welcome here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's the local number. We have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. You may also email your comments, questions to will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, you know, I find myself going back to thinking about what it must be like to grow up in this atmosphere so that you're exposed, so that this kind of violence is around you from virtually from the beginning of your life, or at least that when you're young. And so you get into this situation where people have so little that the only real currency that they have on the street is how strongly they protect their identity as men. That people can't trust the police, so they feel that they have to arm themselves. Being involved in violence hurts in a number of ways, and so you end up, among other things, getting this blunting of emotions so that then people are maybe more confrontational before, or they don't think as much perhaps before walking into situations that can lead to violence. You have people medicating themselves. That causes problems in their lives, including making it difficult for them to get jobs. It seems like this gets so complicated so quickly, and you get locked into this kind of cycle, and you ask, how do you break into that once that's established? If you have somebody who is, 17, 18, 19 years old, and that's been the story of their life to date.
Well, it sounds like a daunting task. I think that we can think about the framework that we use. So typically we think about these young people as either bad or sick. And if we think about them as bad, if that's our mindset, then we feel like the only thing we can do is punish them. And that's basically lock them up. And if we think about them as sick, then we revert to treating them in some way. The treatment is the answer, and it's experts, and that young people don't have any responsibility if you're sick. But on the other hand, if you're bad, you bear all the responsibility. We've begun to think about, with the help of an expert in this area, Dr. Sandra Bloom, we've been able to start to think about injury as the mental model we use for these young people. That is, when you've been injured, all of us are familiar, you have to heal. Some of that responsibility falls on you to heal from the trauma that you've had. But if, for example, you were running one morning and you stepped in a pothole and broke your ankle, we as a community have a responsibility for understanding how you got hurt and what we can do to prevent that in the future. And it's no different here. We believe that these young people, many of these young people, need healing. And they need to understand how the trauma they've experienced in their lives has led to the situation they're in now, and how the trauma they experience in that violent injury may have shockwaves that take them into the future. That is, to me, a more hopeful task. And it's helped by the fact that often the young people themselves who have been through these experiences are our best allies in helping to break this cycle. So I learned a lot of what I know about the situation in the streets from Roy Martin. And Roy Martin was a young man that I met when I had volunteered to be a part of a mentoring program. And Roy was there as a mentee who was in pre-release at the time. He'd gone to jail for a shooting. And as I got to know Roy, I realized that he was a brilliant young man who much of his life had been really taught how to be a fighter and taught how to be in the streets, even though his initial love was for reading and for being kind of a bookworm. And he was actually a talented student. And Roy was raised, he was born to parents who were 15 when he was born. And he told me that basically it was important for me to know that my normal was different from his normal, that the normal that I had experienced growing up with parents who had gone to college and who were, my father was a dentist, my mom was a teacher, that his life had been, I couldn't apply my model to his life. And Roy became my mentor, really, in helping me understand what young people were going through. Roy now provides the same service as part of the health department in Boston to young people, that is, helping them identify ways to heal from their trauma and helping them find ways to get to leave behind many of the things that they've been taught. The truth is that the young people we see wouldn't choose some of the things that they get into. That is, there's nothing really lucrative for most people about selling drugs. There's nothing secure about being involved in crime. These are the kinds of decisions and choices you make when you have no other choice. And so that by providing opportunities for young people to be somebody, and that's how they talk about it, you know, violence can be a way to get an identity and to be somebody. But if there's another way, either through education or through employment, meaningful work, to be somebody, there would be no incentive to do that. Our best, I believe, strategy is to provide, even for 17 and 18-year-olds, we know that a caring adult in your life who's there for the long run, if your parents haven't been able to provide that role for you, is a critical element in buffering you from the effects of trauma. And so mentoring programs that look beyond a short-term engagement but look to engagements over years can be our best strength. Because my experience has been that mentors and so-called mentees help each other understand what's happening and formulate solutions together.
Let's take a call. Now, we have someone in Champaign. This is line number two. Hello.
Hello. Hi. I'm a social worker who works with victims of violent crime, and I also trauma. So I really appreciate your guest. And I was wanting to comment, like, about the employment, the issue about 30 years ago in terms of having lost so much manufacturing jobs where people with, you know, high school could get a decent living, you know, wage. And maybe that had to do with the increase of violence. And my question to your guest would be especially how to address domestic violence, you know, and how the within the small system, you know, we perpetuate the violence, you know. I have seen even in childcare or even when minorities go to those activities like going to a museum and just they're just so repressed, you know, that they cannot experience what's available to them. So that's my question in terms of, you know, how even, you know, that's replicated within the family, the domestic violence, the child abuse, and issues like that, too.
Well, I really appreciate your question because I think you raise a different way to think. If we think about violence in terms of trauma, we get out of the silo where we think, well, there's street violence and there's child abuse and there's domestic violence and there's elder abuse, and they're all different. If we think about them in a more complete framework, research in public health and social sciences tells us that exposure to child abuse and neglect has an impact on whether you will commit intimate partner violence or be a victim of intimate partner violence, and that the trauma that happens to you, the adversity that happens to you as a child affects your likelihood of being involved in other forms of violence and actually affects your longer-term health. And so that if we focus only on one form of violence, we will not accomplish what we will potentially accomplish if we think about how to keep children safe in all settings and starting as early as possible. many of the young people that I talked to who were either victims or involved in perpetrating violence had themselves very early experiences of trauma. Parents who were incarcerated, parents who had substance abuse problems, experiences of neglect or physical or sexual abuse. These are all connected. And so a trauma-informed approach would say we need to not only understand what's happened to people in their early lives, but we need to explore how it is that that's playing itself out in their lives now. And as my colleague, Dr. Sandra Bloom, two things I'll quote her in saying, she says, hurt people hurt people. So the relationship between being a victim and then hurting other people is clear. The other is we need to move to a place where we ask not what's wrong with this person, but rather what happened to this person. That understanding their unique history will help us to have a more complete sense of what their lives are like.
Thank you so much.
All right, thank you. Other questions or comments are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. We'll be here for about another 7-8 minutes. Our guest is Dr. John Rich. He's professor chair of the Department of Health Management and Policy at the School of Public Health at Drexel University in Philadelphia. He's also the author of a recently published book, Wrong Place, Wrong Time, Trauma and Violence in the Lives of Young Black Men, published by Johns Hopkins University Press. And on another point I think it's worth making, and it's here we've been talking about the fact that exposure to violence is a risk factor for then future involvement in violence, either as a victim or as a perpetrator. One of the points that you also make is that growing up in this kind of atmosphere has broad effects on individuals' health, and that it also increases their risk of developing various kinds of chronic disease, and it generally is bad all around for their health in many ways.
That is a critical point. And this takes us to the point about why we all should care about violence and trauma across the lifespan. There's a fascinating and important but not much talked about study called the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study that was done in the late 90s in Southern California. Researchers there looked at people who were part of an HMO, and they served most of the people in the survey were white, most of them were educated, middle class, and they surveyed them about things that had happened to them as a child, and then looked at all of their medical conditions. They looked at 17,000 people, and they surveyed them about the things that we talked about, having a parent who was incarcerated, seeing domestic violence in their homes, having a parent who had mental illness or substance abuse, or experiencing physical or sexual abuse. And they found that there was a direct dose-response relationship between adversity that happened as a child and your risk of chronic disease. In other words, the more bad things that happened to you before the age of 18, the more likely you were to have heart disease, obesity, diabetes, depression, intimate partner violence, intravenous drug use, sexually transmitted disease. The list goes on. And so we know that having adversity in childhood changes not only how your psychological health works, but it changes your physical body. It seems to turn on the stress response, and over time, that stress becomes toxic. We know that African American men have higher rates of chronic disease, have earlier death than other groups, and it's reasonable to assume that some of that is attributable to adversity. But adversity in childhood is a problem for all of us. Not only does it change how effective and productive people can be in our society, it increases the cost of our health care because we're actually contributing to the burden of chronic disease. So we should all care about violence and trauma. It matters to all of us.
We have several callers. We'll see if we can get in at least a couple of them. We will go next to Lafayette, Indiana, line 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Thank you so much. This is the best program on radio I have ever heard in my life. This is the conversation. There were things that I want to say that would only be duplicitous now because no one could say it better than your guest has said it. And I think it's so apropos because America needs to help, needs to understand what is happening in the inner city and stuff, and help them to see why people are the way they are and why they are so much different than what you think is normal and why you can't believe these people are acting like this or do what they do. And that's why they never get a jury of their peers and end up being locked up rather than treated for what really the problem is. But your guest has already brought that up. So anything that I say, he said it all. And I just want you to please give the name of the book again and the guest's name and everything, because everybody needs to hear this. This is a wonderful, wonderful program. And I just want to thank you, sir, for all your research and all your care and concern. Thank you so much. God bless you.
Well, I appreciate the comment. I'm sure you do too, Dr. Rich.
Thank you very much. I really do.
Well, I have a couple of other callers I want to get to, but certainly before we finish up here, our guest is Dr. John Rich. He's from Drexel University in Philadelphia and has authored this book, Wrong Place, Wrong Time. And I'll go over all that again before the time that we finish up, because I'm sure that people will, as a result of hearing this program, I would hope that people would go and would take a look at his book. Let's go to another caller here. This next person would be in Champaign, and line 2, I believe. Hello.
Oh, hi. I have another question. In addition to the peer group, do you also have any body-oriented approach or sensory motor sensory with working with trauma?
That's a great question. One of the things we know from research is that body movement, art, music, all of those things can be healing, and that they resonate with the young people. So we're just beginning to incorporate into the program those kinds of healing arts. And I think that your comment, along with the one of the previous caller, really suggests to us some ways that we can help with trauma. For example, if we know that arts, and we know that physical activity, and if we know that these kind of mind-body efforts can be healing, then when we begin to look at urban schools, we can ask ourselves, does it help or hurt that we pull physical activity and arts out of the school in the name of academic achievement? It may help academic achievement, but if we're thinking about traumatized young people, we would want to hold in our heads the possibility that those activities are helpful in other ways. Similarly, for those who are incarcerated, they need treatment for trauma, and that could happen best while they're there. And so the thinking, it isn't about whether you are locked up or whether you get treated. It ought to happen together, that might improve the outcomes for people who have been incarcerated.
Yeah, that's great, because one of the punishments that I see in schools is to take out the kids' lunch recess, and those are the kids that need that the most.
I couldn't agree more.
All right. Again, well, thank you. Well, let's go see if we can get at least one more call. This is someone here in Champaign-Urbana, line 1. Hello? Yes.
Hi. I wanted to thank Dr. Rich for really writing a terrific book. I, in fact, just finished reading it last week, and so was very pleased to hear you here on the radio. I am a law professor and focusing in the area of criminal law and punishment. And one of the things I was thinking about as I read your book was whether you thought that there might be real implications for the criminal justice system. You've mentioned just a bit about treatment during incarceration, but I would be happy to hear any other thoughts you might have.
Well, thank you. I think you're right. There are implications. At the most basic level, one of the things we think about is whether we can get witnesses to participate in testimony against, for example, perpetrators. Having a trauma-informed approach would realize that the victim is often experiencing lots of symptoms and anxiety and distress, and that we have to address that if we want to help them to be able to participate. But the second thing, I think, would be we have alternative sentencing very progressive ideas for, in some places, for substance abuse, so that we don't send people who have substance addictions to jail. We look for alternative ways. Similarly, for those people who are experiencing the consequences of trauma, we might think about more treatment-oriented restorative approaches that take into account what would help them the most. This is not to say that we should use this as simply a mechanism of defense, but rather to identify what is best for the individual and not only protects society, but protects the individual and helps them to be more effective in the future. So I think there are real implications if we think about trauma-informed law enforcement and criminal justice.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, we're at the point where we're going to have to stop. My apologies. We have one more caller that we simply aren't going to be able to take. We're going to have to leave it at that. But I do, again, want to recommend to you folks, if you're interested in doing some reading on the subject, you should look at the book that I've talked about here and we've mentioned a couple of times. The title of the book is Wrong Place, Wrong Time: Trauma and Violence in the Lives of Young Black Men. It's published by the Johns Hopkins University Press by our guest, John Rich. Dr. John Rich, he's a physician. He's professor, chair of the Department of Health Management and Policy at the Drexel University School of Public Health. That's in Philadelphia. And Dr. Rich, thank you very much for being with us today. We appreciate it.
You're welcome, David.